All right, let's go in our Bibles back to Genesis chapter 40. Genesis chapter 40. Again, you're familiar with this story, but we're going to read it as we work through it today. Genesis chapter 40. And actually, we're going to pick up the story back up in chapter 39, verse 20. It says, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Now, sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody. One night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please, tell them to me." So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." Then Joseph said to him, "This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it's well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit." When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, "I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked goods for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head." Joseph answered and said, "This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. On the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but he forgot him." We're looking today at the dazzling beauty of ordinary faith. I think it's appropriate as Valentine's Day is at the end of this week. Hint, hint, guys. Valentine's Day is the end of this week. Okay, that we talk about some diamond fun facts. Couple things you may or may not know about diamonds. Diamonds are composed almost entirely out of carbon. It's the hardest natural element on earth. There's things that are stronger but not that are found naturally. Diamonds are formed by intense pressure and heat from about 2,000 to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and they form nearly 100 miles below the earth's surface. They're carried to the surface by volcanic eruptions and pressures that drive them up. In their pure state, diamonds are entirely colorless. A pure diamond has no color. But the most popular diamonds, the most abundant diamonds, are usually a yellowish or a brownish in their color. Fewer than 20% of all diamonds actually are the quality that they need to be in order to be a gem.
the largest diamond that's ever been found. It's called the Cullinan. It was found in 1905 in a mine in South Africa. It was given to the King of England, and it was cut into, I guess, 9 large diamonds, 100 smaller diamonds, and 3 of the largest are on display today in the London, the Tower of London, and the Crown Jewels of England. But this diamond, 2.8 pounds. So ladies, you can be thankful your husband didn't give this to you. He loves you, and he proves it by not giving you this diamond, all right? Here's something you may not know. Scientists have discovered a star that is essentially a diamond, okay? The diamond is, I forget how that goes. A carat is less than a pound, and so this is that 2.8 pounds is 3,100 carats. So here's how big this diamond star is. It's 10 billion trillion trillion carats. They named the star Lucy after the Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Okay, that's the biggest diamond that we're aware of. It's a star out there. And again, ladies, you don't have that on your wrist because your husband loves you. All right. I think as we look at some of these different facts about diamonds, probably the most stunning fact is that these rare and precious gems come from an element that's rather common, rather ordinary. It's made out of carbon. You have a bunch of carbon in you. Read one gross thing, wasn't this week, but it was a while ago, that when your loved one dies, they can take their remains and put them under intense pressure and heat and press them together, and then you can carry your loved one as a diamond somewhere on your body. That just doesn't sound like a very precious thing to me. But it's something that's beautiful. It's something that's rare. It's something that is made out of something absolutely ordinary. But it's compositionally transformed away from sight under intense heat and pressure. It sounds a lot like the Christian life, doesn't it? Our proposition this morning is simply this: God is in the habit of transforming the ordinary into the extraordinary. Aren't you thankful for that? Anyone consider themselves as extraordinary? I mean, other than our junior hires here, okay? You consider yourself extraordinary? We're ordinary, run-of-the-mill kind of stuff, aren't we? Okay, we're just nobodies. Okay, there was a time when each one of us thought we were something pretty special. We were all that, and then we were introduced to us. Oh, I guess I'm not all that. Okay, we're not anything extraordinary. We're just ordinary. And then you get married, and you find out that you're extraordinarily blessed, and you're given a child. And you find out that you've been given an extraordinary task. And you look up to God and you say, God, how in the world can I do this? I'm nothing extraordinary. I'm just ordinary. And you've given me such an extraordinary task. Wow, I just can't do this. The beautiful thing about being one of God's children is that God delights in taking the mundane, in taking the ordinary, and transforming it into the extraordinary. But here's the thing. He does it out of sight. He does it under intense heat. He does it under intense pressure. He does it over a long period of time. What we want to look at this morning is the dazzling beauty of genuine but ordinary faith. When you come to the life of Joseph, Joseph's just a guy like you guys. Joseph's just a person like any person in here. He has the same struggles. He has the same passions. He has the same weaknesses. This is just a guy that God uses as an example in this story of what genuine, ordinary faith is supposed to look like. And in the process, God is transforming this rather ordinary young man into something that is absolutely extraordinary. A jewel that he's going to use to bring glory to none other than himself. Again, we remind ourselves, this isn't a story that's primarily about Joseph. This is a story that's about God. A God who's transforming Joseph to bring glory to himself. And so as we look at this passage, we're going to look at five different beautiful facets of what genuine but ordinary faith actually looks like. In the first few verses here, again, we're going to go back through verse 20 of the previous chapter, we see that genuine, ordinary faith is powerfully convinced of God's active presence. It's just ordinary faith, but it's powerfully convinced that God is active in this life and He's present with me. And His presence is an active presence. We see, as the story is told, we looked at it last week, at the beginning of the story, when God takes Joseph out of Canaan into Egypt, he's no longer free, but he's a slave. He's no longer in Canaan, he's in Egypt, that God is still with Joseph. And the text emphasizes that over and over again at the beginning of chapter 39. It comes back and it emphasizes it again at the end of chapter 39. You see it there in verse 21. And the Lord was with Joseph. Verse 23. All these things he left in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with Joseph. There's no bad thing that can remove God's presence from his people. You believe that? Well, yeah, we believe that up here, don't we? That's why we all run to Romans chapter 8. We look at the end of the chapter and it says that nothing in all of creation can ever separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. That's why the book of Hebrews wraps up with one of these astounding reminders that don't covet, but be content with such things as you have because He's promised. He will never leave you nor forsake you. There's nothing bad that can happen in your life that will ever separate you from God's love, from God's presence. We believe that. Okay? We believe that because that's what it means to have faith. That's just ordinary faith. But it's one of those absolutes of ordinary faith. Genuine faith, ordinary faith, absolutely is banking on the fact that there's no bad thing ever, ever, that can separate me from the presence of God. And the text draws attention to this. The Lord is with Joseph. In fact, he's not even allowed to roam free in Potiphar's house. Apparently, he's still in Potiphar's house because that's where the prison is. Potiphar, as captain of the guard, has the prison where the king's prisoners are kept, and that's where Joseph is. But he's no longer allowed to be free in this house. He's a prisoner. But God is with him. No bad thing can remove God's presence. And we see that all good things are the result of God's activity. The text emphasizes in verse 20 that when Potiphar heard Joseph's story, the story as told by his wife, he becomes angered, and the text says, and Joseph's master took him and what did he do with him? What did he do with Joseph? This is where you're starting to fall asleep already. Okay. What did he do with Joseph? He put him in prison. Okay. Does that surprise you at this point in the story? It should. Okay. Who owned Joseph? Potiphar. Okay. What does it mean to own somebody? It means you can do with him whatever you want to do. The ordinary thing that would happen, punishment that would happen for a slave accused of adultery would be not prison, thank you very much. It would be execution. So we should be able to look at this text and say, and Potiphar found out this story and he took Joseph and he killed him. Okay. But he didn't. Why didn't he? He didn't believe his wife. You know what? That was probably part of it. You see in the story that his wife accuses him underhandedly in this whole process. and he's mad. It doesn't say who he's mad at. He probably trusted Joseph to some degree. But again, why did he trust Joseph more than he trusted his wife? Primarily because of Joseph? Primarily because of God. Okay, here's what I don't tend to get in my mind very well. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. I don't think about everything good in my life through those lenses. I think about everything good in my life as, in part, my due reward, my just desserts, the things that I've worked hard to coordinate and orchestrate and bring about and saved and pinched and scraped and denied myself other pleasures so that I can earn this pleasure. But God says, every good thing in your life and in mine is ultimately a result of God at work. Do you believe that? Okay, we believe it up here. We rattle our heads this way. Okay, but still down inside our hearts, we want to be able to nurture and cherish that little thought that maybe I just have something to do with this. Okay? Get that out of your heart. Every good thing in your life rests on God's goodness to you. That's ordinary faith. That's genuine faith. So when somebody asks you, how you doing? And you give that off the cuff, better than I deserve, you actually believe it. Okay? Even when the bad is happening, I'm doing better than I deserve. But ordinary faith believes absolutely, intrinsically, that no bad can ever remove me from God's presence, and all good is the result of God's activity. He was imprisoned. He's not killed. It may mean that Potiphar didn't entirely trust his wife's story. It may show how much Potiphar did trust Joseph. It says that he was imprisoned in this prison. Look at verse 20. He put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. If music was playing while we're reading this story, this would be happy music. Do-do-do-do-do. All right, it's like pointing forward. Something's about to happen. King's prisoners go here. Bing, 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 bing. Get your attention. A little bit of foreshadow. Something's going to happen. Is it just coincidence that Joseph gets put into the prison where the king's prisoners go? Who orchestrated that? God did. God was at work in the selection of where exactly Joseph gets to go. It says, Pharaoh was angry with his two officers in verse 2 of chapter 40. The chief cupbearer, the chief baker. Oh, chief, there's no higher you can go in the baking industry than for baking for the Pharaoh. There's no place higher you can go as a butler, as a cupbearer. He's the one who would be in charge of all the food. He would be the one that would secure it, that would arrange for its being made and fixed. He would put the menus together, and then it would pass through him before it passes to the Pharaoh. He would taste test everything to make sure that nobody was doing anything to his king. He wasn't allowing anything that would reach the king that would be harmful or detrimental. You can't go higher in the cup-bearing business than what this guy reaches and attains to. And Egypt is a force to be reckoned with. He's a world power at this point. Okay, this is as high as you get. The chief cupbearer ever in the world is here. Well, if they had press passes, this guy's in prison. All the press would be there, taking pictures, getting autographs. Wow, what'd you do to offend the Pharaoh? How'd you get here? How did you make your rise? How did you make your fall? They want to know his story. This is the place where Joseph gets to be. Why? Because this is where God put him. Nothing bad can separate me from the presence of God. And nothing good happens except that God does it in my life. This is extraordinary? Nope. This is what ordinary faith looks like. Joseph then is appointed to attend to these prisoners. It says up in verse
Verse 21 of chapter 39, the Lord was with Joseph. He showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners that were in the prison. It connects this favor that Joseph has to the steadfast love that God has for Joseph. The keeper of the prison, the warden, if you will, in verse 21, has favor toward Joseph. We see down in chapter 40, verse 4, that somebody else does as well. 40, verse 4, the captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with these prisoners, so he attends them. Who's this captain of the guard? Flip back to chapter 39, verse 1. Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian. Who is it that put good old Joseph in charge of these prisoners? It's none other than a good old Potiphar. Look up at, let's see, we read it here, verse 7. So Joseph asks Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody, in whose house? In Joseph's master's house, in Potiphar's house. God is working in a miraculous way in this young man's life, a man who's building and growing in integrity, building and growing in faith. God is at work in this young man's life. And God is giving him privileges, and God is giving him favor, and God is entrusting certain individuals to his care. And Potiphar and the warden, they look at these prisoners coming in and they say, you know what, these are important men. We need to have just the right person tending to, just the guy. I've got it, Joseph. And God puts Joseph in charge. He brings them in contact with these men. God, again, is the one who's doing a work in Joseph's life. And only God can get the credit for this, because this isn't primarily a story about Joseph. It's a story about God. We need to keep reminding ourselves of this. Just like your story isn't primarily about you, your story is about God's story through you. This is important for us to remember. Our story is bigger than ourselves. This is a position of authority. In verse 22 of chapter 39, it says, everything's entrusted. It's put into his hand. It's given to him. It's a position of responsibility. He's charged with. He's assigned to them in chapter 40, verse 4. It's a position of accessibility. Joseph is going to use this opportunity to be face-to-face with these men. And he's going to say to him, verse 14, mention me to Pharaoh. You have access to the king. Access that I don't have. Being stuck here in this house, in the jail, in the pit, in the prison. You have privileges that God has given you. You've been given access that I don't have. Will you use that to make mention of me to Pharaoh? When we look at genuine ordinary faith, one of the facets of what just plain old run-of-the-mill faith looks like is the fact that it's powerfully convinced that God is present in my life. And because he's present, he's active. That's why when I take into consideration all of my circumstances in life, I have to say, but God. And that but God makes all the difference for the person who lives by faith. A second facet of the life of genuine or ordinary faith is that it's consistently active in seeking the welfare of others. When God brings us into relationship with himself, it's never just about me and God. God always brings me in relationship to himself so that I can become rightly related to others as well, so that I can bring the benefits that I know of my good God and distribute them and minister those realities to others. A life of ordinary, genuine faith is consistently active in seeking the welfare of others. Joseph's faith, as he's there in the prison, manifests itself in humility. His own circumstances don't blind him to the needs of others. It says there in verse 4 that he attended these prisoners to whom he's assigned. The word attend has the idea of providing them service. What kind of service? Well, it's left open-ended on purpose. Joseph provides them any service
that they need. Again, this is prison, but it's a special prison. It's a prison where important people go. This isn't the chain gang prisoners that he's serving. This is the elite. This is the white collar. So there's special privileges. There's special amenities. There's special things that they're used to and they're accustomed to, and they receive a special treatment. And Joseph's the one who ministers these needs to them. It's a reminder, unlike Joseph, these men are apparently there because they deserve to be there. Look at what it says there in verse 2. In verse 1. The cupbearer of the king and his baker committed an offense against their lord the king. And the Pharaoh was angry with these two officers. They're in prison because they've earned the right to be there. They've earned the wrath of Pharaoh at this point. Why is Joseph in prison? A false accusation. Okay. He doesn't deserve to be there. And so you would think, here's these guys who've committed an offense, white collar though it may be, and you've got Joseph who's committed no offense, whose life is squeaky clean, and who ends up above the other? Joseph ends up below these people, in part putting himself there, accepting the responsibility, serving them, going out of his way to attend them. Literally, Joseph is numbered among the transgressors. And what does he do for the transgressors? He serves them. I find that difficult, personally, because I tend to think of myself as different from or separate than, better than somebody else. See, so when somebody offends me, I don't have the natural tendency to go to Ephesians chapter 4, verse 32, though my dad kept driving it into my head. Okay, whenever my brother would offend me, I felt that I had then the right to nurture and hold that injustice and review it from every different side. But Ephesians 4:32 says, "But be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." There was nothing to forgive for Joseph, and still he puts himself under those who required forgiveness. His own circumstances didn't blind him to the needs of others. His own hurts didn't harden him to the concerns of others. Come down to verse 6. It says, "When Joseph came into these prisoners in the morning, he saw that they were troubled." Does that verse jump out at you at all? What happens to you when you're thrown into your own pit? Injustice is done in your life. You've been kicked to the curb and left to be forgotten. Where's your focus? Man, my focus, man, I've got troubles. Oh, man, this stinks. Where's Joseph's focus? Oh, you've got troubles. Tell me about your troubles. What hurt tends to do for us is it tends to drive us in, except for the life of faith. A life that's transformed supernaturally by the power of God. That focus is changed from, oh, poor me, to, oh, poor you. Can I help you? Where does it hurt? How can I help? What can I do to minister to your needs? Joseph, in the midst of his suffering, is looking out, he's reaching out, he's aware of the needs and the concerns of others. Apparently, he got to know them just a little bit by this point. He sees that their face is changed. He asks them in verse 7, "Why are your faces downcast?" We come to the New Testament, and Paul's writing to Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. He says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition, selfish focus, selfish conceit, but in humility, let each count others," what? "Better than themselves." Do you have a hard time with that? I do. Of putting somebody else ahead of me, of tending to their concerns, tending to their hurts more than my own. Okay. Joseph didn't. And this is just ordinary, but genuine faith. Joseph's faith manifested itself in humility. It also manifested itself in consistency.
In verse 4 there, it says, these men are continuing for some time in custody. That means for some time, they're in the presence of whom? Joseph. So how long do they get to watch him? As long as they're there. They're looking at his life. They're listening to his conversation. They're seeing that when he steps into prison, he may have a song. They're seeing how he lives on a day by day by day by day by day by day basis. They're finding out their estimation of him. They're weighing through. Is this guy to be trusted? Apparently they got to know him. Because down in verse 8, they explain to Joseph their troubles. He says, what's going on? We've had dreams. In fact, we've had dreams and there's no one to interpret them. And the Egyptians placed a lot of credibility in dreams. There were professional dream tellers, dream interpreters. They said, we've had these amazing dreams and there's nobody to help us to understand them. That's our problem, Joseph. You asked. Here's what's going on. They trust him with their troubles, then they entrust to him their dreams. Joseph says, please tell me your dreams. And then verse 9, the chief cupbearer tells his dream to Joseph. Verse 16, hey, wait a minute, I've had a dream too. And he lays out his dream. Do you share your dreams with somebody you don't trust? You dreamed about a what? Tell me that one again. That was really fun. You dreamed about it. Yeah, I love it. I love it. I got to tell my brother. You don't tell somebody your dreams if you don't trust them. How did they learn to trust Joseph? Because they were confined with Joseph in the prison for a long time. And as Joseph lives his life in front of them in prison, they say, you know what? This guy isn't consumed with himself. This guy has a heart that looks out for the welfare. He's genuinely interested. He doesn't just ask how I'm doing and then see how quickly he can run away. He asks how I'm doing and then when I tell him, he stays to listen. Here's a guy I can trust. Here's a guy that I want to trust. Joseph says to them in verse 8, nobody to interpret your dreams, huh? Well, don't all interpretations belong to God? Now, apparently, when Joseph says this, this isn't a foreign phrase that comes out of his mouth, okay? When they hear this from Joseph, this isn't like, oh, turning all churchy on us now, are we? Yeah, I heard the jokes you were telling behind the dumpster the other day, Joseph. And now you're talking about God. This doesn't fit. Okay, go ahead and tell me the interpretation, but thanks anyway. I've got I'm not going to place any trust in that. When Joseph starts talking about God, it fits. Joseph's first thought now turns to God because his first thought at other times have turned to God. They probably got to know that in their time in jail there. How do we know that Joseph's first thoughts turned to God before? Because in the previous story, we're told that when the lady comes and tempts him, he says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against my God? God was right at the front of Joseph's thoughts. Right at the front, and time and time and time again, Joseph is thinking about, and therefore talking about, his God. I wonder if that could be said of us. We're often thinking about, and therefore we're talking about, what? About God. As Joseph demonstrates this genuine, ordinary faith, he's concerned with the welfare of others. He's also boldly willing to speak God's truth. Two different dreams were given them. Verse 5 says, both dreamed dreams, each his own dream, each dream having its own interpretation. One is for good. The content of the first dream is told in verse 12, there's three branches. And Joseph says these three branches represent 3 days. And then verses 10 through 11 talk about how these branches quickly move from bud to blossom to fruit. And then they're squeezed and right away they become wine in Pharaoh's hand. And this process of from planting to blooming to squeezing to drinking is all just accelerated in this dream. And it's all a process. And the whole process moves through.
This is a good dream. The interpretation, he says in verse 13, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. The idea of lift up your head has the idea of when the king would enter into somebody's presence physically, everybody in the room would bow. Okay? And the king then had the permission to lift up your head and summon you to himself and exchange a discourse with you and find out what you needed and carry on a conversation. The cupbearer, the baker, they had permission to be in Pharaoh's presence with their head lifted up. That's quite a position, okay? And he says, Pharaoh, again, will lift up your head in his very presence. You'll have the permission to have that access. What an awesome thing. This is good. The summary of this is the word tov. It's the idea of just good. It has the idea of providing security, order, benefit, kindness, welfare. This is a good thing, and twice. It will be well with you, and when it's well with you, remember me. Verse 16 says, the baker sees it and says, wow, hey, that is a good interpretation. These things are great. One side of the coin, as God gives this dream and God gives the interpretation. Friend, for you, there is good. The other interpretation, not so good. The content looks almost the same. Three baskets, 3 days, verse 18. But what's accentuated in this story isn't so much progress, but chaos. Birds are flapping about, and they're eating food from the baskets that are intended for Pharaoh. And as you see this kind of comical dream unfold, you see that there's three baskets stacked one on top of another, on top of his head, kind of precariously stacked, and they're exposed. The birds have access to the food. There's nothing covering this food. And it may imply that this is how the baker normally did business. He was kind of careless in the way that he provided his service. The interpretation, he says in verse 19, Pharaoh will also lift up your head. He will lift it up from you. The idea is he will decapitate you. He will cut your head off. And then he will hang you on a tree, not a cross like we normally think of. They would take the body and impale it on a stake and stick it out in the sun. Not a good interpretation for this one. Okay, but Joseph speaks it because it's the truth, and it's a truth that's from God. Okay, Joseph wasn't making this stuff up. Yeah. But a life that's ordered by genuine, ordinary faith is willing to speak both the good truth. Hey, there's a God, and He loves you, and there's a heaven waiting for you. But it's also a faith that is willing to speak the bad truth. And if you don't accept this God who loves you and has a heaven prepared for you and offered a sacrifice for you, then you stand in danger of the fires of an eternal hell. Both are true. And both need to be heard. And genuine faith is willing to boldly go there. Even though it's not politically correct. Even though it's exclusive, where Jesus says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, and nobody comes to the Father except through me. Okay, you're not going to win friends and influence people with the story of Jesus, but you may win some for eternity. The fulfillment says it came from God. Verse 20, on the third day, Pharaoh lifts up the head of the baker and the butler. He restores the chief butler to his position, but he hangs the chief baker just like Joseph said it would happen. Verse 22, it says, just as Joseph interpreted it for them. You know, one day, and they're mocking right now, they say, oh, when will Jesus come, you Jesus tellers, you Jesus storytellers? When is this Jesus going to come? He's coming. I don't know, but it's going to be soon. He's coming. He's coming. Yeah. That'll be the day. That'll be the day. But one day, when Jesus comes, that last line will be written in our story as well. just like we said it was going to happen. And the good is going to happen. And the bad is going to happen. And genuine faith is willing to tell that story. We see that we too must be bold to speak God's truth. Genuine faith then, fourthly, and actively anticipates the arrival of justice. Verses 14 and 15 are the kind of the crux of the whole story. Joseph says here, remember me. He makes a request. Remember me. When it's well with you, when things are good for you, remember me. And do me this kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh. He uses a term there that's special. It's the term chesed. It's covenant loyalty. It's steadfast love. Generally, it speaks in the context of a relationship that's already established. It's not a new relationship. It may refer to the time and the friendship and the bond that Joseph and this man have formulated in their time together in prison, but it probably speaks beyond that. He says, will you become the vehicle of the goodness of my God in speaking? He says, and in this way get me out of this house. Joseph isn't ultimately planning on man being his salvation. He knows that the chesed, the covenant loyalty, that steadfast love is from God. He knows that he's being blessed by God. He knows that it's God who's giving him favor. But he knows that God uses individuals, and he's not unwilling to ask. And he says, here's why. This is my request. My reason, I have two injustices in my life. I've been stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. But notice he doesn't say by whom. Who was it that stole him out of his homeland? His brothers. My dirty, rotten brothers. He doesn't say it. Whose house is he in right now as a prisoner? Potiphar's house. Notice whose name he doesn't mention in his second accusation. Here also I've done nothing wrong that they should throw me into the pit. Who's they? He doesn't incriminate anybody. They don't know from whose house he descended to this pit. Okay. But Joseph makes a connection here. He uses the term for pit that was the same back when they threw him in the pit in the wilderness there. He says, you know what? I'm in a place that I don't deserve to be. And I'm not going to tell you how I got here because it doesn't really matter. But I don't deserve to be here. And my heart longs to be out. Joseph's reversal. Ironically, Joseph ends this chapter in the same place that he started. When you move through a story, you generally tend to expect things to be different at the end of the story than they are at the beginning. In this story, they're not. They're exactly the same. Joseph is still in the same place. He starts the story without the guys in prison. He ends the story without the guys in prison. He's in the same spot where he started. He's forgotten. Nonetheless, precisely because he has not been forgotten, this chapter reveals the necessary components that have now been assembled for the reversal to take place. Why is this story here? Because this provides the connection. The reversal has taken place. The man has been put into that position that Joseph needed to know to be mentioned to Pharaoh. It's just not evident yet. Fifthly, genuine ordinary faith patiently endures yet another. Isn't that how you wanted this sermon to end? Okay, have faith, because this is what genuine faith does. It gets ready to be disappointed yet again. Really? I mean, I just got done with a disappointment. A deep, long disappointment. Haven't I got like the disappointment badge for Christianity yet? Don't I get to pass this one? In fact, I think I've got stars on my badge. I've accumulated this. The psalmist says, many are the trials, the sufferings, the setbacks of those who believe in God. But he delivers them out of them all. And faith holds on when again my story seems like it's going nowhere. When again it looks like I'm forgotten. It's significant what the text explicitly highlights in the last verse of this text. Verse 23. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but he forgot him. Consequently, in not remembering, he doesn't show Joseph chesed. He doesn't show Joseph faithful, steadfast love. The text says, the man forgot. But it's significant to note what the text implicitly suggests. But God didn't forget. In fact, that's the whole point of this story. God was doing a work because God didn't forget. God was making connections because God didn't forget. God was actively working, even though it didn't look like He was working, because God didn't forget. God's timing, as always, is perfect. He continues to refine His servant until everything's in place. We don't often think about it, but the next verse is going to say, after 2 whole years, Pharaoh finally dreams a dream. You know what? If Joseph had been remembered at this point, other pieces of the puzzle wouldn't be ready. It would have been too soon. 2 more years were necessary. I don't know why. But think about it from this perspective. Who does Joseph need to bring him out of prison and put him into a position of authority? None other than Pharaoh, right? Joseph needs Pharaoh. Okay, now he has access to Pharaoh because of this cupbearer. Cupbearer is just released from prison. You're Pharaoh. Cupbearer says, hey, Kingy, I got a swell guy I want you to meet. Just brought you out of prison there, fella. How likely do you think Pharaoh is going to be to listen to this suggestion from his chief cupbearer at that point? Probably not real likely. But over 2 years, this cupbearer proves that he's one to be trusted. And when the time comes that God gives the king a dream, he says, you know what, king? I remember. I'm sorry. I should have remembered earlier. But there's this guy back in prison. Really? You know him? I'll take your word. Why don't you bring him? Why don't you send him in to me? You know what? There's a hymn. It was written back in 1929. It reminds us that this is the fact that every Christian banks on. People forget us. God never does. It's called God is Still on the Throne. It says, have you started for glory in heaven? Have you left this old world far behind? In your heart is the Comforter dwelling. Can you say, praise the Lord, He is mine? Have the ones that once walked on the highway gone back and you seem all alone? Keep your eyes on the prize. For the home in the skies, God is still on the throne. God is still on the throne and He will remember His own. Though trials may press us and burdens distress us, He never will leave us alone. God is still on the throne. He never forsaketh His own. His promise is true. He will not forget you. God is still on the throne. God's in the habit of transforming the ordinary into the extraordinary. But here's the thing, folks. He routinely does it in the dark, where nobody else is watching. When you're not in the limelight, when nobody gets to see what God's doing except you and Him, and the pressure's great, and the heat is turned up, and nobody knows how bad it hurts except you. You and your God. Be encouraged. Because God is taking the ordinary stuff of just common old faith, and He's transforming it into something that will bring glory to Him. Let's pray.